Well, good morning. Whoa. Good morning. How's everybody this morning? Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to go, right? All right, I got something for you to kind of wake you up a little bit. This is a letter from a North Dakota farm kid in the Marines. Dear Mom and Pa, I'm well, hope you are too. Tell Brother Walt and Brother Elmer the Marine Corps beats working the old man Minch's by a mile. Tell them to join up quick before all the places are filled. I was restless at first because you get to stay in bed until 6 a.m., but I'm getting so liking to sleep late. Tell Walt and Elmer all do before breakfast is smooth out your cot and shine a couple of things. No hogs to slop, feed to itch, mash to mix, wood to split, or fire to lay. Practically nothing in the mornings. Men got to shave, but it's not so bad. The water's warm. Breakfast is strong on trimmings like fruit juice, cereal, eggs, and bacon, etc., but kind of weak on chops, potatoes, ham, steak, fried eggplant, pie, and other regular food that we used to eat. But tell Walt and Elmer you can always sit by the two city boys that live on coffee. Their food plus yours holds you until noon when you get fed again. It's no wonder these city boys can't walk much. We go on route marches, which the platoon sergeant says are long walks to harden us. Well, if he thinks so, it's not my place to tell him any different. A route march is about as far as our house to the mailbox. Then the city guys get sore feet and we all ride back in the trucks. This next will kill Walton Elmer with laughing. I keep getting medals for shooting. I don't know why. The bullseye is near as big as a chipmunk's head, but it don't move. And it ain't shooting at you like the Higgett boys from home are. All you got to do is lie there all comfortable and hit it. You don't even load your own cartridges. They come in boxes. Then we have what they call hand-to-hand combat training. You get to wrestle with them city boys. I have to be real careful, though. They break real easy. It ain't like fighting with that old bull at home. I'm about the best they got in this except for Tug Jordan from over in Silver Lake. I only beat him once. He joined up the same day as me, but I'm only 5'6 and 130 pounds, and he's 6'8 and nearly 300 pounds. Be sure to tell Walt and Elmer to hurry and join up before other fellows get into this setup. It is really something. Everybody else is just going to come stampeding in when they hear about it. Your loving daughter, Alice. Oh, I love it. Well, we started 2 weeks ago, we started on a trek showing the connectivity of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I likened it to if you were in a book club and you started to read a book and you picked Gone with the Wind and you started reading at the time Atlanta got burned down. You miss a lot of the good stuff. And that's what happens when we don't read the Old Testament. We think, well, we're Christians, we're under the New Covenant, we just read the New Testament. Well, but you miss all the good stuff. In fact, if you're reading the Bible all the way through, from start to finish, once you get to Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, you've already read three-fourths of the book. The New Testament is just the last quarter. And so, in order to understand the last quarter as well as we can, we need to read the first three quarters. And so many times, people don't. They just concentrate on the New Testament. So this last couple of weeks have been hopefully showing the connectivity of the two, how we look at each of the different facets of the Old Testament as it relates to the New. First week, we kind of started off at random. A gentleman in the back said, let's start with Abraham. So we traced Abraham all the way up to Mary and Joseph, remember? And we traced alongside of that all the world empires. So how we got from Mesopotamia to Rome ruling the world. We did all that in one class. So that was the first week. And then the second week, we kind of started with names and we just kept on with names. So we looked at names in the Old Testament and the New Testament all the way through and showing the connectivity of those names. This week I thought, well, since we did names and world empires and the patriarchs, we might look at books. So we haven't talked about specific books. So today I thought we'd just kind of throw it open. What's your favorite book? What book do you concentrate on in your Bible study? Or what book would you like to concentrate on in your Bible study? So who wants to start us off? And it'll be kind of short rabbit trails this week. Yes?
I love
Romans because
it just, lays out salvation and, Jesus' purpose and all of that.
Absolutely. I love Romans. That's my favorite book in the New Testament. Romans is 16 chapters of some of the best reading that you'll ever have. It answers the question in the first 8 chapters. It answers the questions, who gets to go to heaven and why? And that's chapters 1 to 8. And then chapters 9, 10, and 11 tell us what is going to happen to the Jews. Paul is a Jew and a writer of the book, and so he tells us what's going to happen to his people in 9, 10, and 11. And then in 12 to 16, he tells us what we should do before we leave. So chapters 1 and 8 says who gets to go, and chapters, the last chapters tell us what we should do before we leave. And so it ties it all together. Our entire Christian walk is tied together in the book of Romans. I just love the book. We can say that the first 8 chapters are doctrine, and the middle 3 chapters are dispensation for the Jews, and the last 4 chapters are discipline. So doctrine, dispensation, discipline you get in Romans. There's just no better reading to go to in the New Testament than Romans chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8. Those are the most coming alive, rebirthing, regenerating chapters there are in the New Testament. And essentially, it's saying let me tell you a little quick story. My daughter is, she's 39 now, but she used to be 5 and 6 years old when she was in school, and they would have these dances at school. And so she'd come home, and she'd want to put on this dance for us. Us meaning me and my 2 sons, because my wife always used the excuse, or always used the reason to be in the kitchen cooking supper. So I'd get home from work, and she'd come bounding in and say, "Okay, Daddy, I got to dance." And I'd say, "Oh, good. Oh." And my 2 boys would, "Oh, gosh," you know. So, but we'd all dutifully sit down on the sofa together and watch her dance. And this was this big thing to her. And she'd put in a cassette. I'm aging myself. She'd put in a cassette tape, and the music would start. Now, this dance, she just made it up as she went along. There wasn't anything organized to it. She'd just make it up as the dance, as the cassette played. And then when it was over, of course, you know, we'd all, my 2 boys and I'd all clap for, they were her 2 older brothers. And we'd all clap and make over, and she'd just beam, you know. And when we really dreaded the end of the tape, because at the end of the tape, when the music stopped and she didn't, she would go. That meant there's another song coming. And we'd sit and think, "Oh, no." And all of a sudden, the music would start again, whole different song, and she'd do a second one. And she'd get through, and we'd all clap. And you know what? And we did our part, and we played the role, but you know, really, what I would rather have done is just to come home and get in my recliner, you know, put my house shoes on and get in my recliner and just have her come up and sit in my lap and tell me how her day was and what she did at school and what friends she had and what she made. That's Romans 5 to 8. God does not want a performance. He doesn't care. It's fine to go visit people in the hospital. It's fine to win the church chili cook-off 3 years in a row. It's fine to help the Salvation Army bag up groceries. It's great to do all those things. But what God wants is us. He wants us to just climb up in His lap and talk to Him and tell Him about our day and tell Him about the people we met and the things that we did and the things we're exposed to. That is Romans 5, 6, 7, and 8. God wants a relationship, not a performance. I love Romans. Thank you. Favorite book of the Bible. Okay, who else? Yes. Isaiah, yeah. Isaiah is one of the four major prophets. We call them major only because their books are longer, not because they're any more important than the 12 minor prophets. If their book was more than a scroll, they were a major prophet. If it was under a scroll, they were a minor prophet. So don't let the connotation there throw you. There's four major prophets. Who were they? Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. Yeah, those are the four majors. Isaiah is called... It's really neat to read Isaiah just on a standalone basis because Isaiah, a lot of people don't know this or connect up to it. Isaiah is called the mini-Bible. Last week we looked at the books of the Bible. How many books are in the Bible total? 66. That's right. 66 books in the Bible. There's 66 chapters in Isaiah. The Bible is divided up into two parts, Old Testament, New Testament, right? How many books in the Old Testament?
39.
There's 39 chapters in the first section of Isaiah. And then from chapter 40 on to the end is the second section that has 27 chapters, and the New Testament has 27 chapters. It starts out talking about God's... relationship with man and sin and how He's going to bring salvation into the world. I'm talking about the book of Isaiah. Starts out that way. Same with the Bible. Starts out exactly the same way. How does the last of the first section of Isaiah end? Talking about the prediction of a person who will come to announce the Messiah. Exactly like Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, does, announcing the coming of John the Baptist. How does the second section of Isaiah start? Starts talking about a man who eats grasshoppers and who is a voice crying from in the wilderness about the coming Messiah. How does the New Testament start? Exactly the same way. How does Isaiah, the last of the book, end? Talking about a new heaven and a new earth and our place in it. How does the New Testament end in Revelation? The new heavens and the new earth and our place in it in chapters 20, 21, and 22. So, yeah, Isaiah is the mini-Bible. You can read Isaiah and see all of the Old Testament in one book. And then the last half of Isaiah, you can see all the New Testament in one book. Miraculous. Really is. And then there's... And by the way, Isaiah was born... Romulus and Remus were born about the same time as Isaiah, and in fact, we're watching what on TV now? The Olympics, yeah. The Olympics were born at the same time. Yeah, so the Olympics started about the same time as Isaiah was born. And so we call it the mini Bible. There's another connotation in the New Testament, which is the book of Hebrews. And it's called the fifth gospel. And Hebrews, if you are going to witness to someone and you're not going to have time to sit down with them and go through an entire book of the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and say, well, read these four books and you'll find out who Jesus was. If you don't have time for that or if they won't take time for it, send them to Hebrews. Because in the first three chapters of Hebrews, Jesus is perfectly described. He and His ministry on earth. The rest of the book is about his ministry in heaven. So Hebrews is a real good place to go. We think Paul wrote Hebrews. We're not quite sure. That's one of the questions I got when I get up there. I'm going to go find Paul and see if he wrote Hebrews. I think he did, but we're not quite sure. It was in question from the very first century church, but we'll see. Anyway, that's Hebrews. And Isaiah can connect to the Old Testament and the New, and Hebrews can do the same thing. Hebrews does the very same thing. I love the book of Hebrews. It's my favorite book in the Bible. Also, about the time the Olympics were starting and Isaiah was born, and Romulus and Remus were born in B.C., if you take that same date and project it out to A.D., we get the 9th century A.D. You know, we talk about three things a lot in the Bible. What do you think of when I say three? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? The Trinity, yeah. Now, we say the Trinity. Well, I would come back and say, which Trinity? There are three Trinities in the Bible. Two good and one bad. So, now that I've told you that, the first one that's good is who? The Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, right. The other one that's, the other Trinity that's bad is who? Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet. We get all three of those, the unholy Trinity, in the book of Revelation and 2nd and 3rd John. So that's the second Trinity. The third Trinity is in the book of Psalms. And you ought to go read this today because it's really cool. If you look at Psalms 23, what are you reading about? Yeah, the shepherd. David wrote Psalms 23, and he was a shepherd. And as he shepherded his flock, he used the shepherd's crook, right? You say, well, what does this have to do with Trinity? It's the two above. It's the two psalms above and below. So you got Psalms 22 that David wrote, which is an exact eyewitness description of the crucifixion. You say, wait a minute, Psalms? Yeah. David wrote an exact eyewitness description of the crucifixion. It puts you right there on Calvary, written 500 years before the Roman Empire began and they invented crucifixion. Wow. It's an exact description, even down to what Jesus said on the cross. So David writes it, and so that's the cross. And then there's, you guessed it, 24, and David wrote that one, and that's all about Jesus' crown. So you get the cross, the crook, and the crown, the trinity of Psalms in 22, 23, and 24. Read them together, and you'll get so much more out of it. Psalms, middle book of the Bible, right? You just take the Bible and open it up right in the middle, and you're in Psalms. There's 150 of them. Half of them are David's. One of them is Moses, 90. Moses wrote Psalms 90. And the rest of them have authors on about half of them and no author on the other half. But great, great reading. And if I said we talked about Romulus and Remus, that's in B.C., and we talked about A.D., if we project that date, 776 to the AD side, what happens? Well, the Pope and the Catholic Church and the Vatican decides we need to commemorate the three denials of Peter. He denied Christ three times, and that all happened before what? Yeah, before the cock crowed. And so the Pope came out and said, we're going to commemorate those three.
denials. So I want every Catholic church, that's all there was back then, every Catholic church in the land to portray the picture of the cock on their church to commemorate those three denials. Well, all the pastors looked around and said, well, where are we going to put this? They looked up on the steeple and there was a weather vane up there. And so they thought, well, let's just put it on top of the weather vane. It's already there. That's why today you can go down to Tractor Supply and buy a weather vane with a cock on the top. That's where that came from. Cool? Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Some have trains on and I like them too. And then we think of, in Psalms, we think of William Shakespeare. He's in the Psalms. You say, wait a minute now, Don, wait a minute. Psalms written way back. Yeah, he's in there. He's in there because he was a great character in England. Writer and statesman. And when the writers of the King James Version of the Bible were doing all the translations in 1611, it just happened to be William Shakespeare's birthday. He was 46 years old. And so they're translating, and they wanted to honor him. And so as they translated the Bible, they translated the words in such a way that Shake would be the 46th word from the front of the 46th psalm. And spear would be the 46th word from the end of the 46th psalm. And both those put together, Shakespeare in Psalms 46, commemorating William Shakespeare's birthday. Neat? Yeah, see, there's all things about the Bible that connects new history and old history. New Testament, Old Testament. And let's see, there's, since we're talking about the Psalms, if someone comes to you for, or if you're in a situation to where you're called on to support someone or nurture someone, or you know, a friend comes to you and they're really hurting about you know, a death in the family or illness in the family or those kind of things, real tough life struggles, and you speak to them and you say, well, here's what I told my friend, da 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 da. You might remember what you told them, will they? No, probably not. They're all hung up in their sorrow and their strife and so on. They might remember you talked to them, but 5 years later, they're not going to remember what you said. Unless you don't say it. You let God say it. And so all you have to do is just direct them to what God is trying to say to them. And how do you do it? Psalms 34. Whenever you get somebody that needs your help, that's under stress and strain, direct them to Psalms 34. 5 years later, they'll remember that you directed them to Psalms 34, because it'll change their mental state, it'll change their faith, it'll change the foundation of courage that they have under them. Psalms 34 is, well, it's my favorite chapter in the Bible. So, send them to Psalms 34. Yeah. Okay. Have we worked over Psalms pretty good? All right. By the way, one other place that let's see, Psalms 37, I believe it is, tells us that life begins at conception, that people who have had miscarriages and have children die. I have a sister-in-law that had a child die and she had to carry it the last month or so, and even though it had died. Psalms 37 tells us that we're going to see that baby again. It's a very comforting thing, especially for people who have lost loved ones early in life through miscarriage or whatever. My mother had a miscarriage between my brother and I, and she had the confidence of knowing that she's going to see that it was a boy, and I have the confidence knowing I'm going to meet a new brother when I get up there. So, yes, life to God begins at conception. Psalms, great, great part of the Bible. So, what others? What other books do we want to look at? Oh, Proverbs. I love Proverbs. My favorite book of the Old Testament. Solomon wrote three books. King Solomon wrote three books. What were they? Proverbs, Song of Solomon, Ecclesiastes. Exactly. Most people, and I'm in a minority here, most people think that Solomon wrote the Song of Solomon at a very young age, and he was a romanticist and falling in love, and so he wrote Song of Solomon. It's the sex manual of the Bible. If you want to know how to be a better spouse, read the Song of Solomon. And so he wrote it at a young age, when he was young and virile and romantic. Proverbs he wrote at middle age, where he had gained all this knowledge and experience of the world and so on, and so he wrote all these proverbs to teach us some of that knowledge. He was known as the wisest man in the world. And then he wrote Ecclesiastes when he was an old man, senile, didn't know what he was talking about, just an old crotchety, gripey, complainy old guy that nobody wanted to deal with, and so they just stuck it in there. Well, I don't go along with that, and I'm in a minority. Probably 40% of Bible readers don't read it that way, and I don't either. My take is that, yeah, he wrote the Song of Solomon when he was young and virile, that the other two are flipped. That he wrote Proverbs when he was an old man. He had gathered all this knowledge, and he had gathered all of the things about life and lessons and how to grow spiritually and all that over his entire life. And he sits down when his life is almost over. He's an old man, and he writes Proverbs to pass along all this knowledge to us. So we ought to soak it up. But he wrote Ecclesiastes when he was about 40, 45. He's in the middle of a midlife crisis, like a lot of men go through. He was ready to jump on a motorcycle and grab a blonde and head to California. He was in a part of his life that the wheels were about to come off. He didn't know what to do. He'd tried women. He had 300 wives and 700 concubines. Built one house for all 1,000 of them. That would have been tough. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that further builds my point, because when you're going through a midlife crisis, you aren't wise. And he says in there, I've tried women. I've tried work. I poured myself into my work. A lot of men do that in midlife crisis. They turn workaholic. They're gone all the time, and their families don't see them much anymore, and so on, until they get through that period of their lives. So he says, I've tried women, and I've tried work, and I tried wine and drunk all the time, and none of that matters. And like 15 different times, he says, he describes it, it's all a chasing after the wind. What is that in 21st century? It's all for nothing. What am I doing here? All this work and all the affairs and all the workaholic hours and all the beer I've drank and all that, it hadn't meant anything to me. It's for nothing. It's just a chasing after the wind. But in the last two chapters, he finally comes out of the fog He finally realizes what he's been doing is so stupid. He finally realizes the two things that are most important in life. And he lays them out in the last two chapters. And I'm not going to tell you either. You're going to have to go read it. And he comes out of that fog and he gives some of the best advice that we could ever have in life, regardless of whether we're the man or a man in midlife crisis or a woman that's trying to live with him and support him through it. And if any of you have had a man go through a midlife crisis, you know what I'm talking about. The caregiver hurts just as much as the patient. And so that's my take on it. Now, how do you read Proverbs? Well, there's 31 chapters. Every morning when I went to work, I got there a little bit early, I'd pull out my Bible. If it was the 12th day of the month, I read the 12th chapter of Proverbs. If it was the 22nd day of the month, I read the 22nd chapter of Proverbs. There's 31 chapters. Just read them every now and then. I'd have to read two chapters to get that 31 in. I'd just read whatever chapter of the day of the week it was. And after about 3 months of doing that, you will be amazed at the number of those proverbs, of those real life application wisdom quotes from the wisest man that ever lived, spoke directly from God into the book and right off the pages into your life. You'll be amazed how much of it'll stick. It's incredible. My daughter just finished Proverbs for the third time, and now she's going to the Proverbs. We talk about connectivity. Now she's going to switch over to the Proverbs in the New Testament. Yeah, there's Proverbs in the New Testament. Which book? James. James is the book of Proverbs in the New Testament that Proverbs is to the Old Testament. Talk about connectivity. So go read, and it doesn't have near as many chapters. So go read the book of James right after you read Proverbs. The two just perfectly tie together. James, the leader of the Jerusalem church. He was so devout, they called him Camel Knees. Can you imagine why? He was on his knees in prayer so much in Jerusalem that his knees swelled up with calluses. So they called him Camel Knees. James, the writer of the book of James, and was beheaded by Herod, martyred for his faith. Read his book. It's great. I used to teach the book of James, and a lot of it is about what we need to hear today, controlling the tongue. And I would bring a horse's bridle. My next door neighbor had horses, and I'd always, for that Sunday, I'd always go borrow a bridle from him, and I'd bring the bridle in. And as it would go through the book of James, talking about the horse and the bridle, I would show, because most people don't know how a bridle works. I didn't. And it talks about in the book of James how a bridle works and how we should use it. And I would hold the bridle up and I'd show them the pieces that actually fit in the horse's mouth and how it works and how it controls the tongue. And we all need a bridle in our mouth to control our tongue. And James will show you how to do it. It's my favorite book in the Bible. What other books do you like? Yes, sir. Oh, well, that's easy. That's easy. People do ask me a lot, if you're going to start studying the Bible, how would you go about it? I always say start with John. Start with the Gospel of John. I don't recommend people start Genesis and go through Revelation. Why? Because you get tired. You get about halfway through Genesis and you're so confused with the genealogies and the people's names and where they were that you kind of skip over that part. Well, when you skip over that part, then you're not going to understand the book of Leviticus. But you look in Numbers and you read about Numbers. Yeah, okay, I'm all right with Numbers. I understand that. And then they get off into some of the prophets and all the names and they just get lost and they quit. So I always suggest start with the book of John. We have four gospel writers, five if you include Hebrews, four gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew was a Jew, and he was writing his book to Jews. So he was writing to people who were already steeped in Jewish tradition and Jewish law and Jewish terms. In fact, 14 times in the book, he says, as it is written in the scriptures, so it was fulfilled. So he was writing to the Jews. Mark, on the other hand, was writing to the Romans. Would the Romans, who were world dominant, the largest, most powerful army in the world, would Romans, who controlled the world at the time and was all about power and might and control and taking your adversaries and keeping them down, you know, keeping your feet on their neck and all, would those readers care about how a little baby was born in the manger? No. So we don't have birth stories in Mark. Because he was writing to powerful Romans. He wrote about powerful things. So there's more miracles of Jesus in that book than any other book of the Bible. So there's Matthew and Mark. Luke was a Gentile. He's the only Gentile writer in the Bible. he was Greek. And he was writing to the Greeks. And so he, being Greek and growing up in the Greek culture, had all this beautiful flowery language and beautiful at putting words to paper. So is it any wonder that that's who we follow when we have our little kids on the stage for a Christmas play and talks about the wise men and this beautiful flowery language about how the shepherds are in the field at night and all that? Sure, that's Luke. John, however, was writing to universal man. He was writing to mankind all over the world and fulfilling his charge by Jesus by saying, go out and witness for me where? Three places. Where? Jerusalem, Matthew, Samaria, and the utter parts of the world. And John took the utter parts of the world and wrote his gospel to be read by all of mankind, all over the world, all down through these generations. So I say start there. The second reason is he's our detail man. He writes more detail, nitty-gritty detail stuff, than the other three do. So I like starting people on John. And then I'll say, now after you finish John, jump over and read some of the selected Psalms. Not all of it, beginning to end, but selections. And then go over and tackle Genesis. See who Adam was and Eve and Seth, the son that survived from Cain and Abel's situation, and see how those things derived. And then go watch Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner pair off. Pretty good watching. Gives you an idea of the Exodus. Yeah. It doesn't give a whole lot about Numbers, although Numbers is the period of the 40 years of wandering. It touches on a little bit, but doesn't give a whole lot. So you ought to read the book of Numbers. The biggest lesson I get out of the book of Numbers, by the way, it's my favorite book, is I've been teaching my kids this since they were 5, 6 years old. The biggest lesson to me in the book of Numbers is watch what you say. Because what you say can be how you live. What do the people in Numbers say? Oh, gosh, we're going to wander out here in the desert and we're going to be eating sand until we die and just dry up. And the coyotes in the desert will pick away all the flesh on our bones. What's the next verse? They wandered in the desert until they died, and the coyotes picked away at the flesh of their bones. Be careful of what you say. You want to talk negative and talk, oh boy, this is probably going to turn out the worst way it possibly can. Be careful. Oh, I just can't stand that guy. He's just no good. I'm never going to have anything to do with him. Be careful. All negative thoughts should exit a Christian, if for no other reason than the fact that Numbers tells us what you say will many times be exactly what comes true. So if you don't want bad things to happen to you, don't say they're going to happen to you because they just might. And then I tell people to, from there, to jump back over to the New Testament and read some of Paul's work, not Romans. Romans should be your last book of Paul. You should read all of the Pauline books before Romans, because it's totally different. I want you to get a flavor for Paul's writings before you hit the book of Romans. And here's why. Paul had this method of operation. He would go into a new town, Corinth, say, and he would immediately go to the synagogue, and he would preach Christ in the synagogue until they threw him out. Now, he'd convert some, but after a while, the ones that converted were with him. The ones that weren't converted, there were more and more of the majority that were against him. And so he would preach in the synagogue until they just, who was left, threw him out. As soon as they threw him out, he'd go to the Bema. That's the speaker stand in the middle of town square. And he would preach to all the people who weren't going to the synagogues. Who were they? Gentiles. And he would preach to Gentiles, and he would take the believers from the Jewish synagogue and the believers from the Bema and put them together. They'd be at somebody's house, and we call it a church. Now, it wasn't until 177 AD that we started calling them Christians. Before that, they were called people of the way of Christ. And so he would preach, and once he got the church formed, in some places it took him 12 months, some places it took him 18 months. He stayed in one of those towns 3 years. That's the longest he ever stayed. As soon as he got the church established and on its feet, well, he'd leave and he'd go to the next town. And he'd get to the next town and he'd do the same thing. Synagogue first, get thrown out, go to the Bema, start establishing a church. But in the meantime, the people in the first town, let's say Corinth, were having some questions about, well, but what do we do about this or what do we do about that? So they would email Paul in the town he was at, and they'd say, yeah, Paul, what about this? So Paul would then email them back on a reply and say, here's what you do about that. Now, it's that reply email that we're reading in the New Testament. You're reading his reply. So how do you know what the questions were? Well, you can kind of read the answers and kind of figure out what the questions were, right? Sacrificing meat to idols and stuff like that. When he addresses it, that's what some of the questions were. So in Colossians, it's talking about angel worship. And well, then that's what the question was. And so we can surmise what the question was. We see what the answer is by his reply back to them. Now, all of his books are pretty much that way, except Romans, because he had never been to Rome. He didn't establish a church at Rome. And so he decided all of a sudden to write to the church in Rome, and since he hadn't been there to establish it, how would they know his theology? They wouldn't. So he writes Romans since he's never been there, he's never met the people, he wanted to lay out his theology. That's why Romans is such a fabulous book. We get Paul's theology there, where the other ones, he's just answering questions. But we get his theology in Rome. But you need to get to know Paul first, read the easy ones, and then tackle Romans. Because Romans is, it's like swimming through syrup. It's thick, but it's great, and you'll be rewarded for it. Speaking of Rome, each Roman town had a town square. And all of the, this is kind of where we get the West Texas courthouse in the middle of town square. And each one of them would have a little area out here in the middle, grassy area, and all along the sides of the square, vendors would set up their tents. And they could sell anything they wanted to, and you know, kind of like a flea market. Except the north side. The north side of the square was set aside only for the Neiman Marcus products. The best of the best was on the north side. You know, if you were a maker of statues and you were carving in silver, and you're sitting there etching away, or you're carving in wood, and you're carving the statue away, and you've almost got it done, and oh, the knife slipped, and oh, you chopped off the nose. Well, you pick up the nose, and you glue it back on, and you paint over it, and nobody knows the difference, and you sell that sucker. You can't do that on the north side. The north side is for perfect products without glue. And what was their glue? Wax. So the north side was for products without wax. Latin. Sina Sera. Latin word for without wax. The most perfect, pure products on the north side. Only the ones without blemish, only the ones that were completely sincere. That's where we get the English word sincere. It's without wax. It's Sina Sera. And I'm Sina Sera when I say that I've totally, totally enjoyed the last 3 weeks that we've spent together. And I thank you so much for the invitation to let me come. I read in a book about a month ago how to be a better Sunday school teacher. And it said you do three things. You're sincere, be sincere, be brief, and be seated. Thanks. Thank you.